Hello and welcome to episode 2 of the Decarceration Nation podcast, a podcast about radically reimagining America's criminal justice system. I'm Josh Ho, former debate coach with a master's in international relations, who unfortunately received an advanced degree in our criminal justice system after doing 3 years in the state prison in Michigan. I'm currently a freelance writer, criminal justice reform advocate, and the author of the book, Writing Your Own Best Story, Addiction and Living Hope, which of course you can find on Amazon. Joel?
Hi there, I'm Joel Barson. I've been involved in affordable housing work and supportive housing work for many years, and most importantly, I'm a friend of Josh.
Thanks, Joel. We want to also take a second to shout out and thank the band Odonis Odonis for being nice enough to provide the theme music for our show, which I was too dumb to even know that we needed to have some of that, but apparently we do. If you haven't listened to them before, their last album, No Pop, got an 8.1 rating on Pitchfork. They're a really fun band to see live. You can find their music on Spotify, on iTunes, and on Bandcamp. And of course, you can also find it in record stores. I like them a lot. Hopefully you will too. We're kind of not new to podcasting, and so I wanted to make an apology. Apparently, our first episode was a little long. We're going to try to cut all future episodes down to around 30 to 40 minutes. Also, if you're enjoying the podcast, please subscribe. We're now on iTunes, we're on Stitcher, and of course on SoundCloud. You can also see the show notes every week on my blog onpiratesatellite.com, which is just onpiratesatellite, one word, .com. And we'd love to hear your comments and answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Josh. You know, you've done a whole lot in your life, had a lot of interesting experiences, and are something of a Renaissance person. And I think as we go on, a lot of your biography will sort of unfurl. But I wanted to ask if you would share with us what your criminal justice reform work has been as a way of getting into your biography.
Well, you know, after, as I said last week, it became really apparent to me while I was in prison how much, well, and really even before, and we're going to talk about some of that tonight, but how really desperately criminal justice reform was needed throughout the system. And not really just in my case, but really because of all the people that I saw and all the things that I saw during my time in prison. So when I came out, I was pretty motivated to try and make some changes, or at least be part of groups that made some changes. And so I was first in a group called Michigan Citizens for Justice. So I'm still in that group. That's more of a support group. But as a result, I started going to what's called the Michigan Collaborative to End Mass Incarceration, which is a group that combines all the different criminal justice reform groups throughout Michigan. And so I kind of started to get to know all of the different groups. And I was introduced to a guy named Aaron, who runs a group called Nation Outside, also called the Voice of the Formerly Incarcerated in Michigan. And it's a group that I've been a part of ever since. And really what our idea is to try to create collective power from all the people who've been incarcerated before, to try to bring our collective will to bear to try to bring about real reform for formerly incarcerated people. So that's been kind of my major. I also volunteer with a group called the Michigan Council for Crime and Delinquency. But those are the major groups that I'm affiliated with at the moment.
Okay. Thank you for that, Josh.
If anyone wants to learn more about Nation Outside, it's a pretty cool organization. We're trying to do a lot of work to try to help people as they return back to society. And one thing I probably should mention is that, you know, 1 in 4 people in the United States have some kind of criminal conviction or have spent some time incarcerated. And when you think about that, in a sense, we almost have a function. If you combine all the people who've been formerly incarcerated, all of their family members, and all of their friends, we probably have a functional majority. The only reason why we haven't been able to collectively organize, in my opinion, is because there's so much shame associated with incarceration. And so one of the goals of Nation Outside is to try to break through that shame and bring more and more people to bear on the political problem of changing our criminal justice system.
Excellent. So please do connect with Nation Outside.
They have a website. It's nationoutside.org.
Okay. For today, on our agenda are violent offenders, the violent carve-out.
Well, before I mean, I think what my vision is that we're going to try to take a walk through all the different sections of the criminal justice process from the beginning to the end. And kind of one of the first areas to look at is legislation. And the reason for that is before there's anyone ever put in prison, there has to be legislation that says that someone's committed a crime and what the penalty for that is. And that's how prosecutions happen, obviously. And so I wanted to start way at the beginning of the process in this episode and kind of work our way all the way through the process until reentry. So once, you know, we'll do a bunch of different stuff after that, but we're kind of just going to work our way through the entire criminal justice system, I hope. Now go ahead. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Yeah, no, not at all. I mean, we're jumping right in, but we're jumping right in some ways to something that is pretty counterintuitive. At least it was for me when I was preparing for our conversation today. I would think that most people probably believe or might have the notion that one of the reasons for mass incarceration is that we're locking up too many nonviolent offenders, and maybe in particular nonviolent drug offenders. But in some of the reading that we did in preparation for our discussion today, I learned that that simply isn't true. That a huge contributor to the overpopulation of folks in our prisons is the violent offenders we're locking up, and how looking at the way we're doing that and how we're handling folks who are convicted of violent crimes is really important for addressing mass incarceration in our country. And I don't know, Josh, do you want to take it from there?
Well, I mean, as you know, we said last week, America has, without a doubt, the highest rate of incarceration in the world. To put this in a little bit of context, we imprison about 200 more people per 1,000 in the population than either Russia or China, not exactly countries known for their human rights. So, you know, I mean, that's not a good start. You know, in the last few years, there's kind of been a burst of what, you know, people refer to as criminal justice reform activity, and a lot of it has been very good. We registered the second biggest decline in our prison population that we've seen in 35 years over the last few years. However, and this is good news, it's great news, I'm very happy for everybody who's affected by it. But the problem is that decline represented 2% or less of total prisoners. And at the same time, the number of people sentenced to jail as opposed to prison has been increasing. And so while the reform has been happening, it's mostly been happening in ways that don't necessarily show up in the right ways. And the reason for that, turns out, is this distinction between violence and nonviolence. As the Marshall Project mentioned in 2015, simple math shows why violent offenders would have to be part of any serious attempt to have the number of prisoners. Out of the 1.35 million people in state prisons, the Bureau of Justice Statistics reports that 718,000 people were serving time for a violent offense. The problem with this kind of starts with legislation in two ways, really, if you think about it. The first one is we tend to write legislation that creates a distinction in the legislation between what counts as violent and what counts as nonviolent prisoners. Now, that's not a criminological term, and it's not a medical term, and it's something that's made up in the legislation determining what is violent and what is not violent. We'll get to why that's important in a little bit. The second thing that legislators tend to do is when criminal justice reform is suggested, so say I am part of an organization that suggests like an expungement bill, which is a way you clear your record, then a legislator will say, that sounds like a great bill, but let's make a little bit of a change to it. And the change we're going to do is we're going to put a little carve out in there that says that this only applies to nonviolent criminals. And that happens in almost every criminal justice reform piece of legislation that gets passed has this carve out for violent versus nonviolent offenders. And we'll get to why that's problematic for a lot of reasons below. But one of the main reasons that, as we just talked about, that it's problematic is the majority, or at least a fairly high percentage, of the increases in incarceration that are happening right now are violent prisoners. So if your goal is to reduce mass incarceration, you're going to have a hard time doing it if you continue to have carve-outs for violent, nonviolent, you know, between violent and nonviolent criminals. Now, one of the things that is really important when you start delving into this is, you know, what I was talking about a second ago, this notion of how violence is defined. I hate to use, I don't like to talk about my own case too much, not because I don't think it's important, but because it's an example of how this works. I actually think it's really important for me to talk about criminal justice reform as a whole and then use my own experience to kind of bring to bear what we're talking about. But my case was a non-contact crime. Like, it was an internet-based crime. It was non-contact. That doesn't mean in any way, shape, or form I'm saying I didn't deserve punishment. I definitely am okay with most everything that happened. There are some things that we'll talk about over the months that I didn't agree with. But I, you know what, my point is not that I don't deserve. My point is that my crime, despite being literally non-contact internet crime, was coded violent.
It speaks to how arbitrary these notions that legislators come up with for violent and nonviolent really are.
Yeah. And so, you know, I mean, I think if you had a conversation with a bunch of people, you know, about what violence means, you'd think there would at least have to be some physical contact between the people. Otherwise, all crimes should be violent, right? Probably. Yeah. So another example of this is, you know, for instance, in the state of Michigan, where we both live, there's a rule that says that if you commit a felony in, you know, or a, what would be a misdemeanor or any other any kind of crime, if you have a weapon with it, then that can make that crime a violent crime. So, like, for instance, if I was charged with felony reckless driving and I just happen to have a gun in the car, that would be coded a violent crime. So then, for instance, if there was a rule that would, I wouldn't be able to expunge my record because I'd had a gun in my car when I committed the crime, even though the gun had nothing to do with the crime and I wasn't using the gun in any terrible way. There's probably 1,000 examples of this. I think the example I used to think about all the time is when people would, you know, you have this image in your head. I always have it from the movie Heat, of a bank robbery, and there's this person who's in the, you know, there's a person who's there, but they don't know that anyone, that one of the people in the bank robbery is going to shoot another person. That person shoots another person. Now all of a sudden I have a violent crime, even though I wasn't carrying a weapon or anything like that.
So let me interrupt you there, and sort of bring in the devil's advocate position again, Josh. Maybe that'll be my one of my official roles. Okay. In this podcast, is to be the devil's advocate. It seems like we're operating from the premise that something good would be served by incarcerating fewer people, and now we've proceeded to talk about the over-criminalization of violent crime. And I guess maybe my question for you, a question that listeners might have, is what could be wrong about over-criminalizing violent crime or over-categorizing violent crime? I mean, aren't these folks who have done super serious things, and, you know, what's the downside of us treating them in a harsher way, or you know, putting more folks in prison under the moniker of violent criminals?
Well, there's a lot of answers to that question. I'll try to run through as many as I can handle, because there's a lot.
Okay.
First one that I would probably mention is that prison is a terrible solution for violence. You know, we talked about the Rudman study last week. You know, prison doesn't decrease violence. It doesn't decrease crime. It doesn't increase public safety. And there's a lot of reasons why it probably increases violence. In addition, it's pretty costly to society in a lot of other ways. 2016 Justice Policy Institute report suggested that incarcerating violent prisoners costs us $24 billion a year. Think about that for a second. You know, I mean, we're talking pretty hefty amounts of money there. A 2015 study by Michael Mueller Smith suggested that these costs also result in increased welfare dependency. And, you know, whatever your opinion on that is, if you put those two things together, it increases the cost, is the point.
And to circle back to our last discussion, it doesn't seem like there's empirical evidence that all of this results in a safer society.
Right. the majority of studies have shown that prison and harsh sentencing do not have a strong deterrent effect, which is obviously the main thing that you want to do is say, okay, if I'm really tough on people, then they won't commit crimes. We've also already demonstrated in the Rudman study that it doesn't decrease recidivism or make society safer. There was another study done in 2011, and here's the conclusion of that study. And again, with all of this stuff, if you follow the notes on onpiratesatellite.com, I put the links to all the studies and all the research that I quote on those notes. So feel free to go check those out if you want to be able to read the actual stuff. But here's the conclusion of that 2011 study. One of the major justifications for the rise in mass incarceration in the United States is that placing offenders behind bars reduces recidivism by teaching them that crime does not pay. The rationale is based on the view that custodial sanctions are uniquely painful and thus exact a higher cost than non-custodial sanctions. An alternative position developed mainly by criminologists is that imprisonment is not simply a cost, but also a social experience that deepens illegal involvement. Using an evidence-based approach, we conclude that there is little evidence that prisons reduce recidivism and at least some evidence to suggest that they have a criminogenic effect. That means they increase crime. The policy implications of this finding are significant, for it means that beyond crime saved through incapacitation, the use of custodial sanctions may have the unanticipated consequence of making society less safe. And again, like I said about the Rudman study last week, that was a meta-analysis. So it took all of the studies that have been done and concluded the same thing. So this isn't an anecdotal piece of research. It's in line with the rest of the conclusions.
So by over-incarcerating so-called violent criminals, we're creating, in the end, probably a more violent culture.
Yes. And there's a lot of other reasons to be concerned about over-punishment of violent prisoners as well. This is a little bit of a tricky one. I hope I'll explain this right. But defining risk by statute is a terrible way to determine dangerousness. And what I mean by that is that, like I said, violence, nonviolence isn't correlated to any medical term or any public safety term that has any real meaning. It's something that's defined only by legislatures by statute or by our common sense. And that means that saying that there's a difference statistically between a violent criminal and a nonviolent criminal has no empirical basis. Every kind of crime and every individual has different risks for reoffense, and applying universal punishments is a wildly inaccurate way to determine if they're dangerous or not. In other words, some people who we call nonviolent may have a very high risk of violence. And some people that we call violent may have a very low risk of violence, but because we've decided that those are the categories we're going to use and we name people and then put legislation or stop criminal justice reform based on them, we end up with very inaccurate results. So violence is not a very reliable predictor of dangerousness.
You're making me think of the gentleman that we touched on last time, a person you and I both know who was involved in a homicide, but was an incredibly gentle soul and someone who I found to be an inspiring example of someone with a peaceful heart. And I'm also thinking of someone that I work with in my work in supportive housing, who also was involved in a homicide and who also is a person of incredible tenderness, a pillar of the community in which they live. It speaks to this issue, I think, of classifying people by the one worst thing they may have ever been connected to or involved in.
And I probably should also mention here, that's all very true, but we have more predictive, psychologists and psychiatrists have much more predictive risk assessment tools than this kind of ephemeral notion of violence or nonviolence, but we don't use them because we set the statutes up so that we use these fake categories that don't mean anything. They might mean something in certain instances, but they're not accurate predictors of violence. And for the stuff you were talking about, we're going to have a bunch of different things that I think will speak even more to those examples that you gave in just a second. For instance, it turns out, that there's a kind of irony to the way that we deal with this, because In fact, violent crimes generally have much lower recidivism rates than nonviolent crimes. In certain studies, as much as 9 out of 10 people who are convicted of a nonviolent crime don't recidivate. Homicide and sex offenses, strangely enough, have extremely low recidivism rates. The homicide the most, and sex offense is probably the second most in terms of low recidivism. And that you're probably looking, you're looking at me a little crazy, and that's because I think everybody has this assumption that, for instance, sex offenses have a very high recidivism rate, and that's based basically on a widespread, there was a Psychology Today study. It wasn't a study, it was actually, it's a very funny story. I'll attach a link to a video about it on the blog, but it got picked up. This one Psychology Today, which is like, it's like the People magazine of psychology, wrote an article like 20 years ago about sex offender recidivism that ended up becoming used in a Supreme Court case that has then been quoted by presidents, by legislators nonstop ever since. But it turns out it was a incredibly poor study. And almost every bit of information we've gotten since disproves it entirely. But that's still what people know, is this idea of dangerousness. And I'll also put some of that stuff in there.
That's really, you know, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I feel like so many people, it seems utterly pervasive in our society that individuals think that this notion of sex offenders as sort of compulsively driven to reoffend is a given. It's almost like you can't disattach that notion of likelihood of reoffending from the very definition of sex offender. And you're saying it all emerges from this one pop article of sorts in a non-peer-reviewed, non-rigorous magazine.
Yes. And that's well documented. This isn't just me making this up. Like I said, I'll include links to all the data. And this gets us to another point, which I think is really important, which is another on our list here. Violence almost always reflects a moment of time, not inherent danger. Okay, like ongoing inherent criminality. I talked about this a little bit last week. I think I said that most of the people that I met in prison, that they usually were just as surprised that they had committed their crime, or that they were capable of committing their crime, as anybody else was. And that really was my experience, and certainly was my own personal experience. And I think it would be a mistake not to mention that, the way we sentence people and the way that we that is disparate, and I mean that in a racial sense. 31% of people sentenced for violent crime are white, 40% are African American, and 23% are Hispanic. Now, you think about that for a second, you have to remember that African Americans represent about 13.3% of the population, mm-hmm. and Hispanics are 17.8% of the population, and the rest of them are made up in that 31% of white.
So that is some incredibly serious racial disparity.
Yes. And so, you know, when you're thinking of reasons maybe we shouldn't go by this system, one of them is that it's almost always applied in a particular way that is structurally racist.
Right. It's an inherently racist system.
Yeah. And I probably should also mention, in speaking about what you were talking about earlier, that, you know, crime, especially violent crime, when I said that it reflects a moment of time and not inherent criminality, one of the things I left out of there is, in addition to the fact that, you know, it's contextual, you know, like, for instance, if it's a crime of passion or you're in a unique moment of anger, that's usually what most violent has. We only hear about the most extreme, but that's usually what a violent crime is. There's another element of that, too, which is called aging out. And most research suggests that as you get older, you age out of your tendency toward violence. And this is statistically, I mean, every study suggests this, and that's why even parole boards use the aging out as a way to determine risk. And, you know, when you think about that, you're talking about one of the people that we both know. You know, he probably, at the time the crime was committed, had the potential for violence that he clearly aged out of and matured out of. And that happens in a large amount of cases.
And, you know, I think all of us should ask ourselves, perhaps, or maybe even speaking for myself, if I look within myself, can I honestly say that I don't have a capacity for violence?
Yeah, I think one of the things that I've learned in my life is that I think basically everybody has the capacity at any time to be violent, and they aren't aware that they're capable of being violent, so they go through their life saying to themselves, oh, that could never be me. But then there's a moment where you snap, or you get in a situation where things just go wrong and things happen that weren't expected, or you get, and all of a sudden you're doing something you never thought you would be capable of doing. And I think also in, you know, in the field of addiction, what we see a lot of times, or what I've seen a lot of times, is a progressive curve. So you start out doing something that transgresses at a very small level, and several years later you find yourself transgressing at a much larger level because you've kind of become used to the process of transgressing, and it gets easier and easier to cross certain lines. And that's probably one of the last things, last two things I wanted to talk about in this kind of why it's not a good idea to use this kind of system, is that recidivism itself is almost always contextual as well. And what I mean is that when you come out of prison, it almost, or when you're in prison through when you come out, prison almost always means a loss of income, loss of skills, difficulty finding housing, difficulty finding employment. A lot of people, believe it or not, in prison, and if you've ever been there, you understand why, suffer from PTSD. And that's because there's so much violence in prison. I was lucky enough that I personally never had anything violent done to me, but I saw violence on a weekly basis, and I saw some things that were just unbelievable when I was in prison. You know, we'll get to that at some point. I don't really want to be titillating or anything like that. I'm just saying that there's an awful lot of violence, and it can have an effect on people, especially if they're the victims. And regardless of what you think about that, remember that a lot of people in prison are in prison for things that probably, you know, no matter how, like I said last week, no matter how punitive you are, maybe they really don't deserve to, you know, be, and I'm not sure deserve even has anything to do with it. That my opinion is obviously much more broad than some people's. And also, you know, people are isolated from their family and community. And when all these things happen, you're more likely to commit crime again. This isn't an excuse for committing crime, which I think most people hear all this and they're saying, oh, boo-hoo for whatever. The point is, when you have those situations, you're more likely to commit crime. And so our way of dealing with or figuring out how to stop criminality is based in trying to understand all the things that cause it.
Well, I think what we're seeing as we track this is that there are individuals who, in the course of a lifetime, may live a nonviolent life, be involved in possibly a single awful act, and then be placed into an environment that is saturated with violence, in which they're almost can't help but be inculcated and traumatized by a world of violence.
I'm starting to read research. I haven't read enough of it to really feel like I can talk about it too much, that talks about the effect of trauma on the ability to recover from trauma. And so there are some people who theorize that continual violence happens is part of a problem of not being able to overcome trauma. And almost, I mean, so many of the people that I've met, both through talking about addiction and talking about prison and being in prison, you know, had serious trauma in their younger lives. So I also want to talk about shame, too, I think, is the last part of this. James Gilligan, who's a well-known psychologist, has written a great deal about how social shame is one of the main causes of violence. Several books, several articles, very well known. And so one of the big triggers of shame, of criminality, is also shame. And what do we do when people come back from prison? We dump a bunch of shame on them. So again, you know, I'm not saying there's an excuse for criminality as much as I'm saying, are we creating the best mousetrap of trying to reduce criminality? And I would say no. It's like pouring gasoline on a fire when you just pour shame on someone who's coming out of prison, in my opinion.
And it's almost like if we're trying to create a better world, we have the exactly inverse system for doing that. We take people and we put them through the worst possible process for helping them reintegrate into society.
Yeah, I mean, telling people when they come out, you know, you're not going to have any economic security. You're going to have a whole bunch of debt, which we'll talk about later when we get to criminal justice debt, you know, another episode. You know, no employment opportunities, no, you know, no community connections because everyone's supposed to stay away from you. You know, all these, you know, it's just the worst way to, if you were trying to build a way to create crime, you couldn't do a better job than our reentry system, which obviously we'll talk about at a different time.
So what about alternatives, Josh? There's got to be a better way.
Well, yeah, I think, you know, I mean, the first better way is less prison time for violent crimes and maybe even diversion in a lot of opportunity. And everyone's going to go, what are you saying? Don't send people to prison for violent crimes? I'm saying, yeah, maybe. You know, I mean, in certain circumstances and, you know, definitely less prison time. We shouldn't, you know, we shouldn't keep people in past the point when it's beneficial because we know that prisons are ineffective. So by keeping people in prison longer, you're making the problems worse, not better. And so we have to find different, you know, as and I want to quote John Pfaff here, who's a professor at Fordham and wrote a pretty great book called Locked In. I've been lucky enough to talk back and forth with him a lot, and his book has had a really big influence on my thinking in this area. I actually was lucky enough to chat with him a little bit today, which was really cool. But anyway, this is a quote from one of his articles. Violent offender is a common term in the criminal justice debate, but it points to a deep problem in how we approach incapacitation. Calling someone convicted of a violent crime a violent offender suggests that this identity is who he is. He is a violent person, but with very few exceptions, this is incorrect. Violence is a phase, not a state. People age into violent behavior and age out of it, which is what I was talking about earlier. You know, so we should take that into account when we're sentencing people and realize that, you know, when people are in their teens and in their 20s, they're more likely to have, you know, continue to be violent, and they age out of it after that as a general.
So does John Pfaff steer us in the direction of any other alternatives?
Sure. He has, you know, in these next couple of alternatives, he's really talking about kind of gang violence, which is, you know, when you hear the president or other people talking about the violence explosion, which, by the way, isn't true. I've put links in the last, but I'll put links about this too. But anyway, when they talk about that, they're almost always referred to Chicago, and what they're really talking about is gang violence. And when they talk about increased homicide, that's usually what you're talking about. Some might say that that's a little bit of euphemistic racism. I would agree with that. Other people might not, but whatever. So some of the solutions he's seen that have worked pretty well are a program called Focus Deterrence that worked pretty well in Boston. And the idea was to bring gang leaders, community members, and social service workers together, have a discussion and say, if you continue to be violent, we're going to crack down on you really hard. If you choose not to or even leave the gang, here's a bunch of social services we'll provide for you. Here's employment services we'll provide for you. Here's therapeutic services that we'll provide for you, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that's been quite effective.
Sounds like genuinely addressing some of the underlying causes of some of these issues.
Yeah, great. You know, and this the best thing about it is that they're trying to actually, like you're saying, address the problems that most likely cause the violence, as opposed to just punishing the violence, which we found creates more violence. Another example of that is a program called Cure Violence, which tries to treat violence as a public health problem and not a criminal justice problem. And so they try to treat it like a disease and try to deal with the causes of it, as opposed to try to punish it out of existence, which, again, we have found doesn't work. Another pretty successful thing has been what's called hotspot policing, which is making sure you over-police in areas where there's a lot of problems. You know, sure, there's some shifting that occurs, but it's at least been moderately successful, certainly more successful than, you know, the hardcore alternatives. Now, when you get to trying to help people directly, you know, and this has been true in my life, cognitive behavioral therapy, is a really good, especially combined with mentoring programs or programs based around a particular kind of criminal behavior, can be extremely successful. The research on this is pretty extensive. There are some criticisms of cognitive behavioral therapy, but there's also an awful lot of support for it in a lot of research that seems to suggest it works. In particular, it's been good in helping people to cope with anger. And it certainly has been more comparatively effective than prison.
And yet, even with all that, Josh, crimes are still going to happen. There's an inevitability to it. People are going to be harmed, and there are going to be people who cause harm. And that would take us to restorative justice, I would think.
Yes, and I think I didn't mention them before, but I attend all the meetings of what's called FORGE, which is Friends of Restorative Justice Washtenaw County. I'm a pretty big fan of this, and I got into it well before I ever got in the criminal justice system because I did a lot of research on what happened after the genocide in Rwanda. And both in the aftermath of Rwanda and in the aftermath of apartheid in South Africa, strangely enough, one of my graduate studies was African politics. I found out that they applied principles of restorative justice in both of those areas and that they worked. And if you think about what a genocide is, that means someone has just killed almost everybody you know, all your family members, and everyone who's like you in your village or tribe or whatever it was. And somehow, despite that, they found reconciliation between the people who had been genocided and the people who were doing the genociding. And, that's pretty astounding. I don't know, have you had any experience with kind of restorative principles or?
Yeah, thanks for asking. It comes up in the supportive housing world where we are invested in sustaining people's tenancy, even as difficulties come up. And sometimes that means that neighbors cause harm to neighbors. And what we find is that by encouraging a restorative approach to it instead of a punitive one, making eviction the last resort, we're able to heal communities. To help communities heal themselves is actually a better way of putting it, and make communities stronger. And by doing that, the organization that I work for has a 97% retention rate, and that's with folks who have come out of chronic homelessness and whom society has said basically can't live sustainably in community. So I've seen, in my own experience, restorative principles work and lead to stronger communities, and I believe it can make a better world.
One of the things that we can't do in our current criminal justice system, and we don't do, and it doesn't really try to address, is either allowing people to take responsibility for what they've done. In fact, it discourages people from ever taking responsibility for what they've done, because if you do that, you get more of a sentence. And it doesn't ever allow the victim and the person who committed the crime to reconcile or to have any discussion about what happened. And as a result, there's not a lot of healing that happens. And strangely enough, that is one of the reasons why communities don't heal, and why victims don't heal, and why people who commit crimes don't ever make peace with what they've done, don't ever make amends for what they've done, or come to grips with what they've done, is because they're encouraged not to, by the way the system works now. I was lucky enough a couple months ago when we had her come speak here to talk to Danielle Sered, who's one of the kind of leaders in this area. And she works with the Vera Institute, or I think she still does. And she put out a kind of groundbreaking report called Accounting for Violence. And this is a quote from that. Ensuring safety is an urgent and essential responsibility of a society and is a core dimension of delivering on the promise of justice. The United States has been remiss in attempts to fulfill that responsibility because of an over-reliance on incarceration as the primary pathway to ensuring safety. Substantially reducing violence will require acknowledging the limitations of prisons as a strategy to deliver safety or justice, and ending mass incarceration in America will require taking on the question of violence. We might want to incarcerate our way out of violence, but it isn't going to work. And we might want to ignore the question of violence, but we're going to have to address it in a better way if we really want to have better outcomes. You know,
So what you're saying is that anyone who cares about the issue of mass incarceration, and actually anyone who cares about a gentler world, needs to look afresh and put aside their assumptions about violent crime.
Absolutely. And I think hopefully everyone has maybe at least a little bit shifted their ideas, or at least encountered some new ideas that they can read up about as a result of that. That's pretty much all we got for this episode. I think it was a pretty big, chunk of stuff. On the next episode, we're going to talk about another kind of early criminal justice system problem, which is prosecutors. Remember, if you like the podcast, give us a like or leave a comment on whatever platform you prefer. And as I've mentioned several times, a set of notes with citations will be available on onpiratesatellite.com. Anything else you want to say, Joel?
I think that'll do it. Thank you, Josh, as before, for helping me. This was certainly a deeper, surprising look into this topic than I expected. I did the reading that you're going to cite, and I found it to be incredibly interesting, and it moved my thinking, and I appreciate you very much for helping me with that.
Thanks, man. All right, see y'all next time.